From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. Brian Kilmeade here. Rich Lowry coming up in 35 minutes. Congressman Jim Jordan in 15 minutes. I cannot wait to hear from you, too, in the third block of this hour. We have a lot going on today. A lot of things are moving. A lot of things are moving on Capitol Hill, too. Got a lot to get to. Hard narrowing down to big three things. But just keep in mind, too, that if you ever miss the show or you want more on the show, you catch an hour, you miss a second hour, you like a guest, you're going to love the YouTube channel we have, youtube.com/@TheBrianKilmeadeShow. It's really catching fire. I want you to be a part of it. So check it out and tell me what you think. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
The Democrats are trying to find every possible way to pay off their new girlfriend, their voters, which is the illegals, to get money. It is a disaster. We have to stop it.
And that is, of course, Tommy Tuberville, the maybe next governor of Alabama, talking about as a senator, time to give back student loans to banks. That's what Senator Tuberville is pitching. Obama's plan is costing us millions. I'll explain.
Number two.
So what is important and I think different than certainly what Texas did in Virginia is that the maps that the legislature was proposing was before the people, and people very much understood that this is temporary, responsive, and they knew what they were voting for.
Really? A lot of them were confused because you had Donald Trump's picture and said vote yes, when the answer would have been if you want to do what Trump wants, vote no. Virginia gives Dems a big win and possibly House seats. We're going to look at gerrymandering mania and who has the most to gain.
Number one.
Keep in mind that Iran is essentially a partner of the Chinese Communist Party. This is putting the squeeze on China. China finally essentially piped up and said, okay, we got to get the strait opened up.
Rebecca Heinrich's weighing in. We love her. Ceasefire extended, talks delayed. Why I think we are heading back to war. And why it would end, or it's not going to end well for Iran. And a couple of things. So just so you know, in the details, it looked like the Air Force 2 was ready to go all day yesterday. And at first, they were go. Pakistani said, talk to the Iranians, we're ready to go. And then at the last minute, the Iranians said, do us a favor. The Pakistani said, do us a favor. The Iranians can't get on the same page. Evidently, the IRGC was telling the foreign minister and the speaker, you're not going to do this. You are going to do this. They can't get on the same page. They thought it'd be fruitless to show up, so they're not. So the Pakistanis asked the president, can you delay the ceasefire? And he says, I'll give you 3 to 5 days. Because it's not so much they don't like our proposal. They can't get together to find out what they can agree to or not agree to. Is that explained effectively? I hope so. Because it's not political at all. It's a fact. We've killed so many of their officers and their government workers, including the Grand Ayatollah, and his son is so scared he's living in a cave somewhere. They can give him handwritten notes. It's hard for them to get direction, let alone do what they always do. And that's delay, delay, delay. I believe they need to be taught an additional lesson. And I think we got to go back. Now, the bad part about going back would be our Gulf allies are susceptible. The good part about is to we have now analyzed what we did and what we didn't do. We've seen them move. We've seen them dig out certain things. We've seen what's left. And maybe they need to understand how bad things are for them. Again, the horrible thing is for the Gulf states, they're going to be in the line of fire. My hope is that we got them additional drone defense and additional missile defense. Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, who's seen it all, done it all, says this, cut one.
I would just say, let's not negotiate anymore. Let's just walk away. Let's finish the job. And when you think about their fractured command and control, Vahidi's in charge of the IRGC. Under the Mosaic Doctrine, they've broken that down to 31 IRGC headquarters. And they've thought about fighting the United States. So my point to them being fractured in their leadership, which it is because of President Trump and what he has done, as I say, let's create more problems for them and try to figure this out. That's why I keep going back to take something like Karg Island or seize the islands in the Strait of Hormuz with the Tripoli and Boxer orgs that you've got there. And you've got elements of the 82nd and Theater. They can take Karg Island. And all of a sudden now you're creating and compounding the problem for them to try to solve. And I don't think they can solve it because they don't have the leadership left that can figure this out.
We interdicted a ship in the Pacific way deep because it was an Iranian address to it, one of those ghost ships. We've taken one of the tankers because they wouldn't stop after 6 hours. We just blew up their engine and take the ship. It looks like the Iranians took two civilian ships. According to the IRGC, they kept them. One is Panamanian flag. The other is UK flag. They're holding on to them at this hour. Now, they think they're going to hold off the strait and they're going to attack the strait, so that'll shut things down. But guess who they're also hurting? They're hurting the Chinese. The Chinese use it, take 90% of the Iranian oil. They can get almost none of it out. They are bragging that they got some through. Some say they could have gotten some through, but 26 ships, it's not going to happen. When I've told you about that one ship they did capture, it's called the Tiffany. They got them in open waters between Sri Lanka and between Indonesia. It follows the Trump administration directive to interdict any sanctioned vessel believed to be aiding Iran, and they stopped it. So there's a shadow fleet that's out there that we're looking to deny to make sure that Iran feels the pain. It's estimated, President believes, they're losing $500 million a day. Here's Victor Davis Hanson about pressure. He is not only a historian, a military historian. Cut six.
Well, I think he's going to go over there and tell China there's a lot of oil in the Persian Gulf. You've got all the Gulf sheikdoms are happy to sell you oil. And the new regime, if we can get a new regime, it's going to be an open market. You're welcome to come in. Just don't come in with this regime in power and don't buy oil from them and don't sell them weapons. It's very simple. And I think that will give a lot of pressure from China on the regime.
How about buying from us? Let China buy from us. You know, yes, we have very good oil. We can get over there pretty fast.
I think we got a lot of people want to buy from us, though. I hope we have enough oil. Everybody wants to buy from us now.
So you have that, the military, the strategy, the enemy that Bill Clinton, George Bush, all the presidents saw was the number one enemy. Kamala Harris was asked, who's the number one enemy, asked when she was running for president. Iran, okay? But now every Democrat is against the war, every one of them. Listen to House Speaker Jeffries, which I hope every day is never speaker again. He wants to be speaker. He's an aspiring speaker. He's a minority leader. Listen to how irresponsible he is when he speaks. And I think cut nine tells the story.
First of all, we know Donald Trump is the dumbest president ever to sit at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And he's driving our country, our economy, into a ditch.
So the market is around 50,000, just shy of 50,000. Our GDP grew faster than at any point after the pandemic, barring one or two quarters during the Biden years. You just had a guy that could not really speak more than 10 minutes, and you're calling the dumbest president ever, a guy that got elected two times. The one time he wasn't elected, he got more votes than any Republican in history. So you're calling the American people the dumbest people in the history of the world. So go ahead. Senator Tim Kaine, cut seven.
I am glad that the president announced that the ceasefire will continue for whatever the reason. That is a good move. Everything gets harder for everybody if that ceasefire were to have expired today. So I'm at least happy with that news.
All right. So that was semi-responsible. So I'll take that. But for the most part, Senator Tim Kaine, who's still bitter, he lost with Hillary Clinton, even though he got the popular vote. Everything he does, like Senator Warner, who gets read in on the high-ranking intelligence, knows how dangerous Iran is, can't even say things like, listen, I understand the reason to take Iran out. I don't like the tactics and the timing. All they could say is they're essentially cheering for Trump to lose, which is America loses. How do I know that? Just look at what Tim Walz said yesterday in Barcelona and what Senator Chris Murphy has said. Chris Murphy, when hearing and seeing a post from an Iranian official saying they beat the blockade with 26 separate ships, he said, awesome. Later, he tried to explain it away and say, well, I'm being sarcastic, and blame Twitter. Are you crazy? Are you blaming Twitter? What are you blaming Twitter? He says it's a cesspool. Well, number one, why are you using it if you think it's a cesspool? Number two is, what does that have to do with it? It's not like they change what you said. Well, what you mean? Here's Chris Murphy, cut 27.
Twitter's become kind of a cesspool. I probably should give up on sarcasm on Twitter. Obviously, anybody that's seen anything that I have said about Trump's war knows that I think it's bungled, mismanaged, and he should end it as quickly as possible. But sarcasm is not something, I guess, that's allowed on Twitter any longer.
Yeah, by the way, he condemned Trump for taking out Soleimani. I didn't know anybody would do that. When you have the blood of Americans on your hand, when you are literally the foremost number one terrorist in the country, when you tell them there's a travel ban on you and you put sanctions on them and then we take them out, you say that's essentially, you said last time, that's essentially wiping out their Secretary of Defense. No, that's their terror operative working in Iraq to kill 600 plus of our guys and wounding over 1,000. You want to hear irresponsible? And I would say that, listen, if Donald Trump in 3 years, when he's done, rips a Democratic president or leader or whatever, I would feel the same way. Let alone sitting in power, goes to Barcelona to address a socialist conference. Listen to this, cut 28.
We've got a feeble-minded, trigger-happy president who plunged us into a war where no threat was present, with no clear objectives and no exit plan. We need to call that what it is. That's fascism. Or at least it's fascist curious.
I want to bring you greetings as well from a nation that is in crisis. I'm not going to sugarcoat the gravity of what we face right now in the United States. This is the most significant threat to American democracy since the Civil War. Donald Trump in our country is trying to end our democracy.
So just a clown overseas, maybe if he was doing a town hall in Connecticut. Bristol. Okay, a little severe, but he does it over in Barcelona, and people think that basically we're all being held hostage here by a crazy president. 1-866-408-7669. We come back, Chairman Jim Jordan, on what Capitol Hill has got on their plate today. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Giving you everything you need to know. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
With American Home Shield, you can now video chat with live repair experts for help with home fixes over the phone. American Home Shield. Don't worry. Be warranty. Visit ahs.com/listen for 20% off any plan.
Available as a benefit with select plans.
Talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Virginia created a plan that was wholly responsive to the actions of other states and temporary in nature, very clearly preserving our bipartisan redistricting commission into the future. And importantly, that had to go through our General Assembly for two votes before going on the ballot for a referendum for voters. And so what is important and I think different than certainly what Texas did in Virginia is that the maps that the legislature was proposing was before the people, and people very much understood that this is temporary, responsive, and they knew what they were voting for.
So that is the rationale for Abigail Spanberger, the new governor of Virginia, going against a word and redistrict Virginia to an egregious way. Basically, they have a shot of winning 10 and 11 districts now instead of 6-5 in a very purple state. Joining us now is Chairman Jim Jordan. He's with runs the Judiciary Committee and Oversight. Commerce is where he appears. And now he appears with us on Zoom. Chairman, your thoughts about the result in Virginia? It went the Democrats' way, yeah. But just barely.
No, I was hoping we could win this because, you know, it's going to make it tough on four of our members now. And as you indicated, the current map is six Democrats, five Republicans. And now Democrats think they're going to take it to 10-1. I don't know how that's fair. And of course, they just voted this commission in a few years ago. Now they're saying, oh, no, that wasn't good. We're going to temporarily go with this new map. That both times the commission was something that the Democrats wanted, that they thought helped them politically. This is something they wanted and think they believe is going to help them politically. So it was all done for the Democrats. But we'll just have to keep fighting hard and see if we can keep some of these seats in Virginia. And more importantly, or as importantly, keep the majority, because if not, we know where the Democrats are going to go with all their crazy policies.
Absolutely. Impeachment in 2 seconds. So California, they got 5 seats. Virginia, they got probably 4 seats. In Utah, they got another one, they believe, a plus one. But in Texas, you guys are supposed to get 5. In Ohio, supposed to get 2. In North Carolina, 1. Missouri, 1. And now the goal is to flip Florida. How important is Florida redistricting now?
Well, I mean, obviously important because, you know, we're so close. We got just a couple seat majority now in the House. And the way this redistricting phenomena is shaken out, it looks like it may break pretty even. So I think it is important that we can do some things in Florida and hopefully offset the gerrymandering they did in Virginia last night. So we'll see. But, you know, the main thing is I think this campaign is pretty basic. I said this a couple of weeks ago. I think it's two sentences. They're crazy. We're not. And lay out all the crazy positions that the left now takes. And unfortunately, the left now controls the Democrat Party. Crazy to not have a border, which was a situation that we had under Biden. Crazy to defund the police. Crazy to defund ICE. Crazy to say men and women sports. Crazy to shut down the government. 42 days in the fall. What, 60 some days now? I think we're at for a partial shutdown in the spring because of Democrats. Crazy to not have voter ID when you vote. I mean, you can just go policy by policy. Every position they take is crazy. And I think it's important we tell the voters that, remind the voters their positions are crazy, and remind the voters we did what we said. We cut their taxes. We secured the border. And that is going to be the campaign, I think, this fall. And if we're clear about that, I think we can keep the majority.
Act Blue is something in the line of fire. Yesterday, Act Blue employees invoked the Fifth Amendment 146 times when asked if you've gotten foreign money into Act Blue's coffers, which is a violation of campaign finance laws.
Yeah, five people, four of them. Now understand what happened. These five people, right after the 24 election, four resigned and the general counsel was fired. The guy who was fired, the general counsel, got this big severance package. And when we bring him in for a deposition, they all take the fifth when we ask him about foreign contributions. And I think it's important to back up a second. Remember, Act Blue is the money machine behind the Democrats. This is how the left is funded. They raised $3.9 billion last cycle. That is how powerful this machine is. And this was all happening right after the election because we thought some things were strange about this. And were they taking foreign money? They wouldn't answer those questions. But more importantly, the CEO of Act Blue, Miss Wallace Jones, she responded to a congressional inquiry, to a letter sent by Chairman Stiles. She responded in a way that her own lawyers said, you may have misrepresented how we were handling, how Act Blue was handling foreign contributions. And then they fired that lawyer. By the way, that lawyer wasn't just any lawyer. It was Dana Remus, former chief White House counsel for President Biden, who works at Covington and Burling. So they fired their lawyer who said, we think you misrepresented things, which is a nice way of saying you lied to Congress. That's how bad this all is. So it sure looks like they were taking foreign contributions. And we're going to continue to dig into this. Because, again, this is how the left funds all these left wing candidates that are running for Congress now.
So we always wonder, you know, who's going on those streets, who's protesting all these things. You can't have foreign influence in American elections. And the number one, you know, the number one propellant for left wing causes has been Act Blue. And now if we find other countries' agenda is part of this, that is awful.
Yeah. And of course, the irony is not lost on anyone, Brian. Remember, the Democrats have said, oh, President Trump, Russian influence in our election. There was this
Paul Manafort.
Which was all BS, and we proved that. Turns out, though, it at least appears that the foreign contributions may, in fact, have been going to the Democrats via Act Blue.
Chairman Jim Jordan, always great to have you on. You're going to have a busy day. Find out if we get DHS funded. Well, that would be a nice surprise. And the reconciliation package done. Always great, Chairman. Thank you. Coming up next, Rich Lowry. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
I'm Dana Perino. This week on Perino on Politics, I'm joined by Fox News congressional correspondent Bill Malusian.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
Or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Must listen to podcasts from Fox News Audio. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Without a doubt, in the Democratic Party, and I'm the only Democrat effectively left in Congress to support Epic Fury, it's almost as if, you know, we've forgotten on the Democratic side that the real enemy, the real threat, the real danger is Iran and its proxies too. And, you know, every single Democrat, we want to break Iran. We make sure they never acquire a nuclear bomb. As we are approaching that 60 day of the war powers in the law, you know, Iran must be so excited by the American media and the Democratic Party.
There's no doubt about it. Rich Lowry joins us now, editor of National Review. Rich, it's not unusual for people to be critical of a war. Anybody who read the National Review, I'm sure there's plenty of articles in the 60s about the Vietnam War. Remember before the surge, a lot of people that were down that we thought we'd lost the war in Iraq. But I've never seen a war where every Democrat outside John Fetterman is hoping for us to lose. And then you saw it yesterday with Chris Murphy coming out after the Iranian tweet that said that they got 28 ships past our blockade. He wrote, awesome. This is just getting worse. Are you surprised by it, or are you surprised I'm surprised by it?
I'm surprised you're surprised by it, given okay. What we know about where the Democrats are on foreign policy and where they are on Trump. But the Chris Murphy thing, I mean, it's really James Bonda-level stuff. Now, he hasn't gone to Iran and sat atop a drone the way James Bonda did with an anti-aircraft emplacement in North Vietnam. But why are we rooting against the United States? You can say this is imprudent, shouldn't have done it, you hope it ends soon. But it's a good thing if we succeed, by definition, if you're an American patriot. But a lot of Democrats aren't there now.
Yeah, I want you to hear, of all people, Chuck Todd was on Meet the Press for the longest time. Now he's doing his own thing. Cut 23.
Some people who are not Trump fans are like happy about this. We shouldn't be happy about this. This is a disaster.
No.
He has screwed up this country and our foreign policy for decades. And we're going to be paying a price for this for a long time. Some of it might be at a gas pump. Some of it's going to be in bad trade relations. Some of it is going to be the Gulf states deciding they can't trust us anymore. This is going to have such a long tail of bad. So what I don't want to see out there is people like ecstatic that Trump's finally, like, everybody's finally noticing he's a bad president or something.
I agree.
Like, somebody, this is nothing to be excited about. This is a disaster, and he's our current commander in chief, and he's screwed this up 10 ways from Sunday.
Well, I mean, I could not disagree more. But his point is, why you're celebrating it? My thing is, he has a chance of being the best foreign policy president ever. We're maybe referring to as a situation with our allies, but he's just going out of his way to point out how the allies have been freeloading in every step, in every way, shape, or form up until now.
Yeah, I don't get this about Gulf allies. I think they'll be disappointed if we just walk away and don't get it in a much better place. They've seen what Iran is, if they had any doubts before, and if they have to choose between Israel and Iran, they're clearly with Israel. So that seems all net pluses. So we are stuck, though, Brian, with that they have de facto control of the strait, and we're blockading them. And Trump clearly doesn't want to start bombing again, although, you know, he may need to reestablish leverage. So I think where we're headed is some sort of deal here that's kind of unsatisfactory, that is JCPOA-like, probably a little better than JCPOA, but we'll see. But on top of that, you have this massive destruction of their missile program, their nuclear infrastructure, their military, and their economy. So they're going to be in a much worse place coming out of this than they were a month ago or a month and a half ago. And that's a very good thing for U.S. national security.
Yeah, I talked to a high-ranking official today. And the only reason why people think we're stuck, he really can't get the Iranians to speak with one voice. They, according to the Pakistanis, they are literally were stopped. The foreign minister and speaker were en route, and the IRGC said, don't go. Let alone, what are they agreeing to? So we really, right now, don't have a partner, and perhaps they're looking right to the supreme leader, who's so scared, he's in a bunker, and you can only get handwritten notes to him. So it's hard to negotiate with a side that can't deal with each other.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. It shows a fracturing of the regime that ultimately, you know, could result over time into the regime falling apart. Now, I wouldn't necessarily predict that. I don't think it's going to happen on a convenient timetable for us, but it's certainly possible. But we do need, they can exact pain on us. That's the problem. If they didn't have de facto control of the strait, you know, we'd have all the leverage in the world. We could wait if we wanted. We could sign a deal if we wanted. We'd just walk away if we wanted. But we can't do that with them controlling the strait.
So the admiral in charge right now came out and said, in a matter of a day, we could grab the strait back. The question is, you know, how secure that strait would be, but we can grab, there are plans in place right now. The problem is getting those fast boats, the Mosquito Navy, but you could begin to open it up and you could begin to do escorts. The question is, why are we even doing that? as we just had with Adam McRaven. McRaven says if they want us to get rid of the blockade, it takes very little effort to put it back on. If they want that blockade gone in exchange for the straight open to go into talks, do it. How do you feel about that?
I totally agree with that. I wouldn't be surprised if that is what happens ultimately. But it also may be that we need to demonstrate that we can reopen the strait in a day, to get them there. So we'll see.
Here's the Chinese foreign minister, cut 25.
The situation in the Strait of Hormuz is sensitive and complex. China expresses concern over the United States' forced interception of relevant vessels and hopes that the parties concerned will act in a responsible manner, honor the ceasefire agreement, avoid aggravating confrontation and escalating tensions.
So they know that they get 90% of Iran's oil goes to China. And now we intercepted one of the Chinese vessels that had dual-use material on it to make bombs. So they have, even though they got reserves, they're going to be really feeling it shortly.
Yeah, and you know they for being an ally or de facto ally of Iran, they have not rushed to their defense. They clearly want the strait open as well. This is a problem Iran has over the long term. It's just everyone's going to want it reopened. And at some point, if it's not reopening, we're going to go do it by force. As the Admiral said, we could do it. It might be painful. It might be protracted if you begin escorting ships. But it's within our power. I just think Trump is hesitant to do it because he'd prefer just to sign a deal with it without further military action. I'm just not sure whether the Iranians will let him do that.
All right, so I want to pivot to yesterday's results. It was just a point and a half, but Virginia will flip and make it a 10-1 district, 10-1 state in terms of Democrats and Republicans, in terms of pickups. Your reaction to the gerrymandering, which for now, until the court rules, has gone the Democrats' way in Virginia.
Well, it's a disgrace, but for their partisan purposes, Brian, if everything nets out in the rest of the country, there's no wins or losses net. In the House, for Republicans or Democrats, just what happened in Virginia will win the Democrats the House. They need to pick up 4 seats to win the House. That's 4 seats right there. It's so outrageous because we saw last night, it's a purplish state, right? This wasn't a blowout the way it was in California. If Republicans had spent a little bit more, they might have won, and they only lost by 2 points. But then you're going to get an 11-1 congressional delegation. You're going to get a more Democratic congressional delegation than they have in Illinois. You're going to get almost a Massachusetts-like congressional delegation. I think Massachusetts is 9-0, so at least there'd be one Republican. But it's totally unrepresentative. So to portray this as defending democracy the way Barack Obama and others have done is completely preposterous.
And I don't believe it's going to be temporary, but I will say Texas, they got 5. Ohio, they got 2 Republicans. North Carolina, they got 1. Missouri, they got 1. And now they're going to go Florida where they could get 5. So that would give them a net gain if Florida's maps get passed through. And of course, a judge still has to look at the gerrymandered Virginia, right?
Yeah, if the judges do their job, they'll strike this whole thing down. But I wouldn't have a high level of confidence that they will.
All right, the Southern Poverty Law Center is now under federal indictment for what they say is taking their money and financing groups called the KKK. How about this group? You have the this group called the Aryan Race, $300,000. $1 million for another white supremacist group. So they were trying, they put together the Southern Poverty Law Center to fight groups like that. Now it turns out they were financing these groups in order to create some unrest and greater need for things like the Southern Poverty Law Center. That's what the indictment basically says. And think about in Virginia what happened. In Virginia, they had the good people on both sides speech that the president made. That Joe Biden says propelled him to get into the race, that he had to get in and become president to stop Trump. And it turns out they were financing the KKK.
Yeah, what a scam. So this is what all organizations run into, is if they win the fight, they're winning. There's no reason for them to exist, but they don't want to go out of existence. The one I can think of, there's something called the Committee for the Free World. That was an anti-communist organization. And when the Cold War ended, they just said, okay, we're shutting our doors. We finished our job. Now, actually, they should have stayed in existence because we have China. But this is crazy. This organization has always been one of the most poisonous in the country, and that they were funding the kind of groups that they wanted to fight. It just tells you all you needed to know. There wasn't enough racism to justify this organization, so they had to create it on their own.
So they paid $3 million secretly funneling to extremist groups like $1 million for the National Alliance Affiliate, which is a white supremacist group, $300,000 for the Aryan Nations, $270,000 for the Charlottesville Unite the Right rally. Remember, Unite the Right is what caused all that unrest. $73,000 to pay a former KKK guy to infiltrate the KKK. Here's what Jonathan Turley says when that suit was filed. 6 counts of wire fraud, 4 counts of bank fraud, 1 count of money laundering. Listen.
This center has been controversial for years, in addition to criticizing Turning Point after the assassination of Charlie Kirk. The center has also targeted groups like Focus on the Family because of their religious views and what they've said about LGBT values. So the group itself has sort of drifted from its original and legendary purpose in litigating against segregation and things of that kind. It has become a more blatantly political organization. There's going to be serious free speech associational challenges that are raised. But as you know, Ansley, this is just an astonishing system that they created that looks like a mini FBI.
So, by the way, it's Ansley. This is what the indictment says. Basically, they were creating unrest to justify their existence and raising more money.
Yeah. So how many years did we hear about the Unite the Right rally, right? That it was an indictment of Donald Trump. It was an indictment of conservatives generally and an indictment of America because we're so racist and had all these Nazis. Now, it was a very small event, just on the merits. But now we know it was a bit of a scam. It was funded by these people. So this level of cynicism and corruption are just off the charts.
Rich Lowry, thanks so much. Lastly, before we go, just want to get you on the column you wrote about Michigan's Dearborn Democrats. We have Hassan Piker, who is a force there. We have a Senate candidate who is not disavowed, Hassan Piker, who basically is an Islamist. And who basically will get the Islamic community voting for him.
Yeah, so we have a lot of right-wing influencers that are anti-Semitic or dabbling with anti-Semitism. They've had no effect on the orientation of the Republican Party, whereas the Democratic Party is lurching in this poisonous direction.
We'll see what happens, and hopefully there'll be Senator Rogers, who almost won last time, because there are enclaves in these places in these states that really are not interested in being American. I'm thinking about the Somali community in Minneapolis, and I'm thinking about this Dearborn group. Rich, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Back in a moment.
Big guests, bold opinions, better information. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This week on the Fox True Crime Podcast, psychotherapist and author Lena Dorhaly breaks down the mind of Chris Watts and the warning signs behind one of America's most disturbing family murders.
Listen and follow now at foxtruecrime.com. Information you want, truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
If the Democrats win the presidency on both sides of the Congress, I think on day one they should take Puerto Rico, D.C. a state, and should expand the Supreme Court to 13. Eat our dust. The only way to fight this is don't run on it, don't talk about it, just do it. She said, okay, we got 54 senators and we got 13 court members. Thank you, goodbye. Because you're not going to get a fair shake any kind of way in this system. 18% of the United States elects 52 senators. Well, you're not going to make it equitable, but you'll make it better by adding Puerto Rico and D.C.
So that is James Carville, who is a good soundbite, but he's absolutely nonsensical. Remember, he guaranteed you Kamala Harris was going to win big. I'm not going to forget that. That's how much he knows. And I'm not sure he's sober most of the time he speaks, but who knows? But if you sound drunk and you're not, I don't know what's worse, being drunk or just acting drunk. But I want to play it because he has impact. And of course, anytime he's on, he gets ratings. But this is one thing that Republicans should use in every market, big and small. Just so you know, if you elect me, this is what I'm going to do if I'm a Republican. I'm going to seal the border. I'm going to be strong on defense. I'm going to look to be fiscally responsible. I'm going to look to be law and order. These are just four things off the top of my head. And then whatever that district needs, especially, you know, whether it's a farming, rural, or urban community, usually rural if you're a Republican. Democrats are saying, I will change the country. I will get rid of the filibuster, which means, you know, easy an executive order is to implement. You sign it. The bad part about an executive order, the minute the new executive comes in, they will decide your party or not, whether that stays in place. But if you pass things through legislature, you got to, undo it through some type of law. If you get rid of the filibuster, which I know some Republicans are for, I am not for, it is going to be head snapping change every single election cycle. You're going to get so angry that things change so rapidly, you're going to make sure to go to the polls and get that guy or that woman out, and it's going to go back and forth. Puerto Rico should not be a state. It should be evaluated. It should be debated by an entire country. And if there was another state out, another, let's say, Guam or someplace that was Republican, I wouldn't say make it a state. Are you kidding me? On a simple majority vote? Washington, D.C. was a compromise. It should never be a state. It's not big enough to be a state. It can't function as a state. It's not worthy of a congressional seat. It's not worthy of two senators. But the only reason they think it is, you know why, same reason why Maryland is blue, that they'll be blue. So if James Carville says, just change the country, change it left. Let's go back to green energy. Let's go back to weak on defense. Let's go back to men and women's sports. Let's go back to being politically correct. Let's go back to extreme environmental legislation. Let's bring back the red tape. Let's weaken our defense. I mean, that's what'll happen. There'll be no room for a John Fetterman in your party, a Joe Manchin, a Kyrsten Sinema, who have other views and other agendas that are more reminiscent of the people that put them in office. So I'd run on that. James Carville, if I'm Republican, James Carville would be in all my ads. Because they're also going to say this, 25th Amendment, impeach. If you want to make sure that Donald Trump's party stays in power, keep saying that. And I would put it in all my ads. You got a Democrat. You're not going to get their agenda. You're just going to get the anti-Trump agenda. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. Tell me what you think about that. I'll be able to read that next time. Keep it here.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
All right, from 40th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan on the 15th floor. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Admiral William McRaven, one of America's real heroes, is going to be in studio. Brand new book, Duty, Honor, Country, and Life, a tribute to the American spirit. And he has got a great book out to really symbolizing America 250, bringing civility back to this country. Daniel Turner in 15 minutes. Well, we're going to talk about energy in this country and he is a founder of energy advocacy group, Power the Future. And the market is way up. It's just shy of 50,000 again. So oil is also up. It's $91, just up $1.87 because everything's on hold, which brings me to the big three.
Number three.
The Democrats are trying to find every possible way to pay off their new girlfriend, their voters, which is the illegals, to get money. It is a disaster. We have to stop it.
And that is Tommy Tuberville, student loans. Time to give back student loans to the banks. That's what Tommy Tuberville is pitching. Obama's plan is costing us trillions. I'll explain.
Number two.
So what is important and I think different than certainly what Texas did in Virginia is that the maps that the legislature was proposing was before the people, and people very much understood that this is temporary, responsive, and they knew what they were voting for.
That is Governor Abigail Spanberger. Virginia barely beats the Republicans and gets those additional House seats by a severe gerrymander. Miriam, what does it mean for the entire country? Because other states have been gerrymandered. We'll talk about where it stands now and who's next. And I believe it's Florida.
Number one.
Keep in mind that Iran is essentially a partner of the Chinese Communist Party. This is putting the squeeze on China. China finally essentially piped up and said, OK, we got to get the strait opened up.
Yeah, but they told Saudi Arabia to do it. Saudi Arabia cannot open up the strait. Ceasefire extended, talks delayed. Why I think we're heading back to war, and it'll probably be the end of Iran. That's how I think we're heading. Do I look forward to it? No. But I thought after the pounding of 15,000 separate sites, after losing most of their nuclear operations, uranium still buried, after losing their traditional Navy, still have their mosquito Navy, and paying the price they played with their leadership, I'm up to 80 number, up to 80 are dead and more are targeted for death if we go resume. You would think that Iran would get the message. Instead, you have a fracture at their leadership. What do I mean? Well, their military, the IRGC, which is separate even from their traditional military, which numbers over a million, the IRGC smaller but more powerful and more radical, they are telling their foreign minister, their speaker, yeah, I don't think you should go to the talks. So just as the Air Force Two was fired up, ready to go with the vice president getting on with Witkoff and Kushner, they were held up for hours and finally they shut it off because the Pakistanis told the president they're not showing up. And then the president said, he goes, don't end the ceasefire. They urged to wait a couple of days because it's not a matter of them blowing you off. They can't get on the same page. So that's why they're standing. I got to give the president credit for something else. It's not getting a lot of publicity, but what he's did is told, while we wait to find out who's in charge of Iran's delegation, he's asked for the commuting of the hanging of nine women who were caught up in the protest for women that want rights, want to be able to go to school, live a normal life, not wear the head apparatus that they have to wear. They were arrested, and now they're set to be hung. He's saying, don't do it. And for a gesture of trust, don't hang these women. And that's really what prompted this and the nuclear program together. When you kill between 30 and 41,000 people in cold blood, you pile up their bodies, you charge their families in order to pick up the bodies and then charge them for the bullets used to kill their loved ones. You know how brutal this regime is and the message they're trying to send. When they get them some type of arms or get that internet fired back up, people like Dennis Ross, who knows this region and that country well, say, you know what? They will turn over leadership. Here's Rebecca Heinrichs, Cut 10.
Well, this is really interesting because keep in mind that Iran is essentially a partner of the Chinese Communist Party. And so was Maduro-controlled Venezuela. If you take Venezuelan oil, combine it with Iranian oil export, that's about 18% of Chinese oil imports, of what China imports. So it really puts the squeeze on China if you're blocking that Iranian oil. And of course, the United States has already planted the American flag in Venezuela, and we're working with this interim government since we snatched Maduro essentially from his bed in Venezuela. So this is putting the squeeze on China. China finally essentially piped up and said, okay, we got to get the strait opened up.
So they have blockaded the strait. We've blockaded every port. So they shot and took two ships, one UK, one Panamanian flagged. So they took them this morning. We have taken one, and then we've taken another off the coast of Sri Lanka because it was heading, one of those so-called ghost ships, heading to Iran's direction. So we're pretty much in a standoff now. So Steve Yates on Fox News at night said this about what's going to happen, because as the president mentioned, and no one's really argued, they're losing about $500 million a day. For a country with 140% inflation and a worthless currency, that's tough. Cut 15.
I think the president has been gradually upping the pressure and upping capabilities to compel an outcome. I think the last part of this at this point is going to be the financial tools that are in the Secretary of Treasury's hands and keeping the embargo in place. I really don't think they have more than a matter of days, if at most a couple of weeks, before economic pressure is overwhelming for whatever the remnants are trying to hold on to.
Now, on the other side, Republicans are feeling the pressure. Why? Because gas prices are high. It was one of the things they were hanging their hat on. Why? President's approval rating has dipped down, not quite as low as it's been published, but it's slow. I get it. But it can quickly reverse. This thing gets wrapped up in a positive way. Gas prices go down almost immediately. We've seen that in the past. If you just look at where gas prices were when he took office and how quick they came down when he came to drilling and getting rid of regulation and letting everybody in the oil and gas business know, I'm in this to drill and I'm not going to hit you with environmental credits and demand that you use solar panels on your Volkswagen, then people are, then business is going to respond. That will help a lot. But Olivia Beavers on the Wall Street Journal said this last night, cut 12.
I mean, we're in a war where you're going to see both sides claiming victory. I think the president's claimed victory multiple times so far, and we still are engaged in military operations with them. Republicans seem to be getting a little bit more uncomfortable as the time the war drags on. And that's something that they wanted and hoped would be wrapped up quickly before the midterms. But it seems like the president's also feeling a little bit more bullish and willing to, you know, block the Strait of Hormuz and take a more aggressive stance. So you're starting to see maybe a little bit of a schism there.
Look, we are refired up. The vehicle, everything's maintenanced. We've got more assets into the area. We have three aircraft carriers, which we don't need all three, evidently, reportedly. But we have all three ready to go. We're overprepared to finish the job. I'm sensing, even though the Gulf states will pay a short-term price, I'm sensing we do it. Now, should we take off? Take out their power plants and their bridges. The risk is, and Admiral McRaven will expand on this, the risk is that they hit desalinization plants in places like Kuwait, where 90% of their water's from. Can we protect it by now? It's been enough for a number of weeks. Let's see. Doesn't take much to hurt it. You know, get one drone that gets through. Daniel Turner's coming up next. I don't want to take too much of his time. Just remind you, you miss any piece of the show. You can only see, listen to 15 minutes or watch 15 minutes a day. Most of our guests are in studio or on camera now through Zoom. Go to YouTube.com at the Brian Kilmeade Show. It's our YouTube channel, which is on fire right now. I hope you like the clips. I'm going to be putting more and more up there. Don't move.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. His mouth to your ears. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I don't know. That could happen later this year. That might not happen till next year. But prices have likely peaked, and they'll start going down. Certainly with the resolution of this conflict, you'll see prices go down. Under $3 a gallon is pretty tremendous in an inflation-adjusted terms. We had that in the Trump administration, but we hadn't seen that in inflation-adjusted term for quite a long time. We'll get back there for sure.
But the Chris Wright saying it's going to take maybe to the end of the year for $3 gas really turned the president the wrong way. And by the way, I don't think he's right. And he's the expert. I get it. Because look how quick the price of oil and gas came down after President Trump took office. Why wouldn't it be the same thing again? Daniel Turner joins us now. Founder of Energy Advocacy Group known as Power the Future. Dan, who's right, the president or is it Chris Wright?
I'm going to give credit to the president here only because of what we have seen in the past. When he was sworn in 2025, it was a matter of weeks till oil dropped to $65 a barrel and gas came to, you know, $2.85 a gallon. And the reason why is because the markets had this stability. Permitting was happening, financing was happening, infrastructure was being built. There was no obstacle for them to produce. Right now, there are no obstacles either. There's just a lot of jitters around, obviously, what's happening in Iran, and that has everyone on edge.
Right. So oil is up slightly. It's still under $90 a barrel, but the market seems to love it. Now, there is oil and gas companies. Are they making money in this?
They are definitely reaping profits, but they're spending those profits because unlike in the past, they have something to spend those profits on, right? So if you're a huge oil company and you do have excess money, what are you doing with it? Well, you want to drill for more oil, right? And now you can because Alaska is open. The Outer Continental Shelf is open. The Gulf of America is open.
Right.
The coast of California is open. Right. So if you want to produce oil, if that's your job, you're always looking for opportunities to produce more oil. For 4 years under Biden, they would say, hey, gas is oil is $130 a barrel, but you can't do anything with it. So they bought back their stocks. They gave each other bonuses. And then they got yelled before Congress. You greedy SOBs, right? Who are you making money? What else am I supposed to do with money? Right now, they have something to spend money on, which is capital investment
industry. How come Joe Biden's prices went down eventually during his administration after the Putin price hike, air quotes? And what he did was drained our reserves and bought more from Venezuela in a deal with the devil.
Yep. And prices really didn't go down. They went down from their all-time highs, but his average was $95 a barrel. So we're kind of at Biden-level pricing now. Now, Trump didn't run on Biden-level pricing, obviously, but we saw in the first 13 months of his administration that prices will come down pretty darn quickly.
So not only is there a Republican in office with a different philosophy when it comes to climate change, But you also have a different country now.
Yeah.
You say, you pointed out to me, no one's talking about climate change.
No.
So even they're trying to get office, win over their party, vilify Trump. They're not saying climate change, give me a solar panel, or give me death.
No.
So, and today is Earth Day, right?
Yeah. And normally, especially here in Great New York, there would be huge demonstrations in Central Park. All the freak shows would be out banging drums in Washington, D.C. Maybe it doesn't help that it's kind of ugly and rainy here right now. They don't like to protest in bad weather, right?
I heard that.
We had this miserable winter. You know, no one was gluing themselves to traffic when there was 4 feet of snow on the ground and it was 20 degrees, right? So they're going to wait for the spring and the summer. But this is their sacred high holy day, and none of them are out. And the reason why is because even their side realizes it's a failed message.
So when I went down to Midland, Texas to do a story on oil and gas, because I knew I don't have that background in it, and I was talking to these people in their 50s and 60s, and they said they were being actively discouraged in school, their kids were, from getting into their business, as if it is the mob or getting involved with an underground gang.
Yeah.
And they couldn't believe it. They were getting vilified by their own kids. Has that changed?
No, but it's changing, and I think we're heading in a good direction. There are cultural educational issues. You look at your average kid's grammar book or English textbook, it's riddled with climate change nonsense. Just a constant indoctrination of all these things. Look at, you know, may he rest in peace, the previous Pope, Pope Francis. He talked about gun runners, pornographers, and fossil fuel executives. He lumped them in this. I know a lot of fossil fuel executives who are wonderful, devout, generous Christians, patriots, and they'd be like, I'm sorry, pornographers, right? And then the Pope would get on a private jet and fly somewhere. So.
I'm so done with this Pope and weighing in. We did a whole special on Fox Nation yesterday that aired live just on the Pope and the president.
Yeah. Like,
what is going on? You also, on a side note, had the Catholic Church. Evidently, there are a bunch of Catholics in China that want to be able to be Catholics, as opposed to the ridiculous religion China makes them worship. If the Pope wanted to weigh in, go to bat for those Chinese Catholics that are hoping not to get executed. Here is President Biden as he talks about what matters to him.
The climate crisis doesn't care if you're in a red or blue state. It's an existential threat. We have an obligation, not to ourselves, but to our children and grandchildren, to confront it. I'm proud of how America at last is stepping up to the challenge. We're still going to need oil and gas for a while. But guess what? No, we do. But there's so much more to do.
So I'm getting flashbacks and going through PTSD. But that's what you had to deal with.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're talking with Daniel Turner, who's an energy expert. Man, we do need him now. And that's what the oil and gas industry said. This is the guy in charge. So he's going to make it hard for us to continue to expand our business.
And because of the climate crisis, as they so called it, look at what they did. We'll just take New York as an example. Under the previous governor, Cuomo, and under the current governor, Hochul, they've shut down around 5 or 6 reliable coal plants. They shut down a nuclear power plant. Now New York utilities are 40% higher than they were.
And the Democratic governor says, oh, can we slow this climate schedule down a little bit?
The ban on gas stoves, they've stopped pipelines from coming from Pennsylvania. The shocking thing is that Pennsylvania, which is not very far, is the second largest producer of natural gas in the nation. You could build a pipeline effortlessly, especially through upstate New York. Gas, electricity should be almost an afterthought. Yeah,
I know they're trying to do a deal with the Secretary of Energy and Interior to get a pipeline through in exchange for letting them keep congestion or some windmills and congestion pricing. Where's that at?
I believe that it's the Constitution pipeline, and I believe the permitting for that has gone through.
Good.
As we're in the matter of the construction. But again, these are things that should have been built 5, 6, 10 years ago.
And I know people have this perception of New York City. It's all New York City. It's not.
No.
If you gave New York the opportunity that Pennsylvania has, they could be a natural gas capital. There's a lot of natural gas, and these people in upstate New York need an economic opportunity. But we passed on it thanks to our ridiculous previous governor and the current governor.
And the thing that's infuriating about the climate movement, especially when it comes to policies, is that they never look at it and say, okay, well, this failed. Let's reverse it. It's just doubling down. So you've shuttered all these reliable fossil fuel plants.
Right.
Utilities are through the roof. No one says, well, that was a bad idea, right? Maybe we should do something different? Nope. You just do more of the same, and you continue to inflict this pain on your constituents.
So the market's up 414 points. It's approaching closer and closer to 50,000 because we're not having war right now. How much Does America need the Strait of Hormuz?
For global prices, right? We are on a global pricing.
Do we physically need it? We don't need it.
We don't need it, no. But it does affect global pricing. I compare it to another commodity, gold. Gold in Japan is the same price as it is in America, right?
Are you comfortable always? Is that way we're going to be the rest of our lives subjected to global pricing when it comes to oil and gas?
I think so until we start really outproducing them or until we control a lot more of the world's oil and gas region. We now control Venezuela. I don't see America foregoing that anytime soon. Yes, we'll cooperate. The people of Venezuela will reap some of the rewards.
And they should.
Absolutely. I think President Trump wants to do the same thing in Iran. I think he wants to take over that, and then we control where it goes, and that means it doesn't go to communist China. It doesn't go to our adversaries.
Well, how about they pay what they're supposed to pay?
Yes.
Right? And just how about that? They're not getting the steep discount in Venezuela, and 80% of Iran's oil is sold against sanctions to China.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what could break this impasse, by the way.
100%.
All right. Daniel, always educational to have you in, and always great. Daniel Turner, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Coming up next, Admiral William McRaven. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I would just say, let's not negotiate. Let's just walk away. Let's finish the job. And when you think about the fractured command and control, Bahiti's in charge of the IRGC. Under the Mosaic Doctrine, they've broken that down to 31 IRGC headquarters, and they've thought about fighting the United States. So my point to them being fractured in their leadership, which it is because of President Trump and what he has done, is I'd say let's create more problems for them and try to figure this out. That's why I keep going back to take something like Karg Island or seize the islands in the Strait of Hormuz with the Tripoli and Boxer Orgs that you've got there. And you've got elements of the 82nd and theater. They can take Karg Island. And all of a sudden now you're creating and compounding the problem for them to try to solve. And I don't think they can solve it because they don't have the leadership left that can figure this out.
So that is Lieutenant General Kellogg weighing in on where we go from here in light of the fact that yesterday we had Air Force Two ready to go with the Vice President, Steve Witkoff, and Jared Kushner to fly into Islamabad, 18 hours, by the way, 18 hours, and then became clear the Pakistanis said they reversed course and that the Iranians will not be sending a delegation. And he said they have a fracture on their side. They can't get on the same page, so they decided not to go. I guess the IRGC won that argument as opposed to doing a deal with people that can't actually cut the deal. That's one thing the vice president said last time. In the 21-hour negotiation, it became clear in the middle that the people we were talking to did not have the authority to agree to anything, which is a bit of a problem. So the chaos ensued. There is no agreement. The president extended the ceasefire 3 to 5 days, and Kellogg says, hey, you know what? I would just say, let's finish the job. What does Admiral William McRaven think? He's retired U.S. four-star admiral, served on the Ninth Command, the Ninth Commander of the United States Special Operations Command, and the author of a brand new book, perfect for 250, called Duty, Honor, Country, and Life, A Tribute to the American Spirit. Admiral, always great to have you in.
Yeah, good to be with you, Brian.
So we hit the ground running. That's one lieutenant general's opinion about where to go from here. Love yours.
Yeah, well, one, I love Keith Kellogg. It's always enjoyable listening to him on Fox. I probably disagree with him in some respect. So I teach a class at the University of Texas, the LBJ School of Public Affairs, on national security decision making. And I put the students in a simulated, situation room. They play members of the National Security Council. And I give them a framework for thinking about, how are you going to make national security decisions? And one of the things I tell them is you have to ask yourself, the decisions you make and the actions you take, will you be in a better strategic position after you do this? So as we think about where we are now, what does the president want out of this? I think the president wants the Straits of Hormuz to be open, and he would certainly like to get the nuclear material back in his hands, or at least he'd like to convince the Iranians not to enrich more past the 60% that some of this highly enriched uranium is. You're going to have to get them to the bargaining table, to the negotiation table to do that. Right now, I think the only way to do that is to say, look, we will lift the blockade. And I know that's not popular, but the blockade is a switch. You can turn it on, you can turn it off. We will lift the blockade. You come to the negotiation. It's just like the ceasefire.
But you actually unblock the strait too, right?
Well, the strait is to some degree open a little bit. I mean, we haven't blockaded the strait. We blockaded the ports.
No, I know. Would you also tell Iran, open up the strait?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So open up. So in this ceasefire period, open up the strait. We will lift the blockade. You come to the negotiating table. If we're not able to negotiate a deal, and the two deals is the straits stay open and you don't enrich past a certain point, then we blockade again. And again, you can turn that on and turn that off really rapidly. So I don't think the president is giving up anything by saying, let's lift the blockade for a period of time to bring them to the table. Then if they don't want to come to the table, they've got no more excuses. Then the president's in a position to say, okay, look, I gave you an opportunity. Now maybe we go on and do strategic strikes.
So as you did, then you sit down. So let's say they still don't want to sit down. You
sure.
Lift that. And the IRGC, there's an excellent chance that we're dealing with a group that feels as though by surviving, they're winning.
Right. Absolutely.
So yep. How much damage would you go, you as a commander and let's say a secretary of state, when would you bring the military option back?
Yeah, I think you've got to give the negotiation a little time. What people don't realize is even to negotiate the JCPOA with people that were professional negotiators, it took 18 months. Now, the president clearly doesn't want to wait 18 months, but you're going to have to give the negotiation a little time. But, okay, let's say the negotiations don't go as planned. Yes, you reblockade the ports, and then you begin to escalate again the strikes. You got to be very careful about going after the power plants and these sort of things because the Iranians still have a lot to play. They've got a lot of drones. They've got a lot of short-range ballistic missiles. They can then attack, you know, the UAE and Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and their Arab neighbors in a way that's really going to disrupt the world economy.
So I mentioned this to you in the green room before Fox and Friends today, Admiral. But, I mean, we do now have a week and a half, 2 weeks to maybe get some missile defense to protect those desalinization plants and maybe protect the vital areas. And now we have the defensive drones the Ukrainians have provided instead of using the Patriots to knock down $100,000 drones. So how much of an adjustment have we made, do you think, from the contacts you have and the reasonableness that you have?
Yeah, I think, you know, we've certainly put some of the high-value targets, some of the refineries in, and again, I'll be careful here, but in some of the Arab states, we have resupplied them with some additional Patriots. But the fact of the matter is, I don't think we have enough Patriots to cover every gap. So the Iranians could clearly find an opportunity. I mean, you talk about launching hundreds of drones or ballistic missiles. They could still get through and do significant damage to some of the power plants or the desalinization plants that are along that you know, Persian Gulf coastline.
How much progress do you think we've made in observing how much damage we've done and what the Iranians have done to try to fix things during the ceasefire period? Do you think we're still learning a lot right now?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, we have unfettered access to the skies, and our satellite imagery and the intelligence community certainly has a good understanding of the damage that's been done and what the Iranians are trying to do to rebuild it. But I think people, they don't quite understand how large Iran is. I'm from Texas. Yeah, Texas is a pretty big state. Iran is 2.5 times the size of Texas.
90 million people.
Yeah, so, but when you think about, well, why don't we just find these little boats, these, you know, fast boats along the coast? Well, that's like looking along the entire east coast of the United States and trying to find a Boston whaler. These are not easy things to do, even with the military that we've got. So can we see if they're, you know, rebuilding or digging out from Natanz or Qom? Sure, of course we can. But the threats that exist today are a lot, again, of these fast attack boats, of the drones that are in bunkers and cave complexes, and, of course, the ballistic missiles.
So you've thought about this, and you've war planned around this almost your entire career.
Right.
Because Iran's been my whole adult life, Iran's been an enemy, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So when this is nothing new to you. It's just about when we were going to take them on in some way, shape, or form. And you also probably know some of the 600-plus that lost their lives in Iraq
through
the insurgency sponsored by the EFPs made by the Iranians, let alone the thousands that would have been wounded. You might even know some of the 241 that were killed in Beirut. Yeah. Along with the hostages that we're taking. So knowing that they have this long track record of and blood on their hands, how has this conflict played out differently than you thought, and how much was it very similar to what you thought?
Yeah, so make no mistake about it. The Iranian regime has been horrible since 1979, And you laid out all the issues, Brian. I mean, the fact of the matter is they have killed hundreds or thousands of Americans, or been responsible for the deaths of hundreds, if not thousands of Americans and our allies. Their proxies, you know, the Houthis, Hezbollah, Hamas, have continued to do damage around the area. So nobody is losing any sleep over the Iranian regime and, again, the destruction that we have that we've levied on them. That's all well and good. But I get back to the strategic position. So at the end of the day, the president has to look strategically. Every president since 1979 has wanted a change in the regime. A lot of the times they haven't done it because there were some things that were pretty obvious to the military. You know, one, it's very difficult to change regimes, as the president is finding out. You've wiped out all the senior leaders, but guess what? This regime runs wide and deep. Also, we've never been able to bomb our way to victory, right? So this idea that we could, you know, level the key infrastructure in Iran and they would just somehow give up, that's never been the case in modern history.
Because it's so blatantly, they're blatantly unpopular with the people.
Well, sure.
And they never got elected to power. So it's not right. Like you're going with 90 million against the rest of the world. You're probably going with what? 500,000
sure.
Tops?
Yeah. Well, yeah. And, you know, 200,000 probably just in the IRGC that are keeping an eye on a lot of these other folks. But yeah, so again, the president wanted the Iranian people to rise up. That's going to be really hard. And you never, ever, ever, ever talk about Iran without talking about the Straits of Hormuz, because that is always their leverage point. So the president going forward, if he wants to find himself in a better strategic position than he was before February 28th, then he's going to have to figure out how do you get him to the table and negotiate something that opens the straits, reduces their enrichment of uranium, and maybe we move forward.
So I love your book, the concept of it. It takes a lot of your speeches, which you're great at not only delivering but writing, duty, honor, country, and life, a tribute to the American spirit. And what prompted you is 250. You want people to understand we've always been arguing. We've
right.
always been disagreeing. But what's different now is we seem to have lost the ability to do it constructively.
Right. Right.
So how does this book attack that?
Well, I talk about in a lot of the speeches, and of course, as you know, Brian, my speeches, they're stories, and they're stories of great Americans I've met, great people I've met across the country and across the world that have inspired me. So part of the book is, look, if you're starting to lose a little faith in America, read the book, and I think it will help you regain that faith. But another part of the book is to look at where we are 250 years into our democracy. And when you look back over our democracy, look, we've had problems, but we have always overcome them. And one of the key attributes that has allowed us to overcome them is our ability to be civil. And I mentioned earlier this morning on Fox and Friends, George Washington had a little book that he carried with him called The Rules of Civility and Decency. And he really lived by those rules.
He wrote them?
No, he did not write it, but it was
a collection of what he learned.
Yeah, and no, it was a little book that had been written, but he carried it with him everywhere, and he, you know, passed it out to people because he wanted his officers to understand what was important about generalship, about citizenship, and so being civil was part of that. And then about, I don't know, 100 years later, you have John Stuart Mill comes along, and he writes a book called On Liberty, and there's a whole section on civility. And Mill's point was, look, it's okay to disagree, you know, but people need to have competing ideas. But at the end of the day, you can't get competing ideas to solve problems unless people are civil in that part of the discussion.
So I made probably the most famous speech you gave is 2014 University of Texas commencement speech, where you talked about making your bet.
Yeah.
And it's a small book, but man, it was a bestseller forever. But it was based off that speech. That's one of your stories, right? Do the
sure.
little things right, and the big
That's
things
exactly
will fall
right.
into place.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what other speeches did you build off of in this? And what about your family's influence, being that your dad served in World War II?
Yeah, well, of course, yeah, my parents are a big part of my life, as parents and guardians and coaches and teachers are. So I have a number of speeches in here. I gave a speech to the MIT graduating class in 2020. I've given a speech to the National Football Foundation to talk about football. And my father was a professional football player. And he always believed that, you know, how you played football between the lines, between the 120 yards on turf, was how you ought to be a man, you know. Respect your opponent. Be humble. Respect the rules. But I've got speeches in there to the law enforcement officers. That's the first speech in there that I gave in 2011 after the bin Laden raid, to talk about how much I appreciated what law enforcement officers did. I've got speeches to the National Historical Society. But again, all of these speeches, and to Irishmen, there's a I gave a keynote speech at the 200th anniversary of the Hibernian Society in Savannah. And the point about the quote unquote Irishman is that we all have a little bit of Irish in us. You know, we want to fight the good fight.
Right. And the thing is, Admiral, a few more minutes when we get back. But you as an Irish guy also know that people fight. But I think one of the most inspirational thing is when they hug at the end.
Yeah, absolutely.
You were literally beating each other for 12, sometimes 15 rounds back in the 80s. And you would hug it out. So if they can do that.
That's part of the respect.
That's right,
Brian.
Back in a moment.
Real talk, real guests, real insight, where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. It's out this week, right? Right, Admiral? It's called Duty, Honor, Country, and Life, a tribute to the American spirit. Are you looking forward to July 4th and all these things celebrating our 250th birthday?
Of course. I mean, look, as I said, this experiment in democracy, and this is a grand experiment. We're not there yet. But when you look back over 250 years, one, we're the longest democracy in the history of the world. And for all of our missteps, and there have been a few, this is still the greatest country in the world, and we ought to celebrate it.
What do you see your role as probably one of the most well-known and respected leaders of your generation? Is that why it's important for you to make these speeches, to put so much time into it, and then put this book together?
Yeah, I mean, the point is, and I say it right up front, and look, this is, every time I write a speech, I try to make sure that it is a speech that I think reflects the values that we admire in America. It is about courage. It is about integrity. It is about humility. It is about compassion. It's about thing I think that the founding fathers looked at and said, these are important qualities and we want to bake them into our DNA. And everywhere I go, probably outside the political arena of Washington, D.C., there are terrific Americans out there. And yes, we disagree on a lot of things, but as we approach the 250th, we need to celebrate the good of America.
So you're worried about social media. People talk about how it polarizes.
Yeah.
Are you kind of heartened by the fact that we have a generation now in their teens that say, I'm not going to get caught up in that. I see how the manipulation's happening.
Yeah.
We see schools pushing back on the iPads. And even if they're, it's no political agenda, it's no one's learning the way they used to, no one's interacting the way they used to. I think we're seeing a reawakening from the last time you were here.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's a new book out called The Anxious Generation, or it's been out for a little while, and it talks about the impact of iPhones and iPads and these sort of things.
And you've seen it.
Yeah, of course. And so I am concerned, and I've got a couple of grandchildren, and their parents, my kids, are very, very careful about giving the grandkids access to iPhones too early. And so you do worry about that. But, you know, we talked about earlier in the green room before Fox and Friends about civility. And I think what has generated a lot of the incivility has been the social media, because you can be anonymous.
Right.
So you can get out there and you can rail away on somebody and never put your name on it. And then you feel like, well, that emboldens you to go out and
get some followers.
Yeah, of course. And be more and more mean-spirited. And then at some point in time, you think, well, I'm getting a lot of followers. I'll put my name on it. And then that's who I'm going to be. And that does not serve America well.
How about with AI, people saying, let me let AI tell me the answer to this question. write that speech.
Yeah, no. You know, I use AI to do some research, but I'm always a little careful because, you know, I use it almost like I use Google, but I never, ever, ever have it write anything for me. Part of it is I just don't ever want to be, you know, accused or somebody say, well, this looks like it was written by AI. No, no, no. Everything I write, everything I put to paper are my original words. Now, I look again, I'll look up, tell me about Brian Kilmeade. Tell me about his history, that sort of thing.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah.
Most of it's negative.
Well, but the other part is a lot of it's not accurate either. So you have to be very careful with AI.
So that's why the green room. That's why our green room conversations are so valuable. Hey, guys, pick up this book, especially if you have a birthday, Father's Day coming up, or Mother's Day in 2 weeks. Duty, Honor, Country, and Life, a tribute to the American spirit. Admiral William McRaven, always great.
Great to be here, Brian. Thanks.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's Brian Kilmeade Show, and I am right here. Martha McCallum's going to be on this hour. That's going to be great. We just had, we're trying to keep up with the breaking news as the ceasefire's extended. We know that. And also, we are trying to keep up with everything else that's going on, including, we have not talked a lot about it, but there's a lot going on when it comes to what's happening in schools and what's happening with the Southern, the Southern Poverty Center. It turns out that they are working both sides of the fence, which I'm going to expand on in a second. So just keep in mind, too, go to my YouTube channel, youtube.com/@TheBrianKilmeadShow. If you ever miss a segment or want to see an entire interview or you miss it, or you want to see the visual, we're rolling on this. We're rolling in the studio all the time. We got three brand new cameras, and the channel is really exciting. And Martha McCallum's coming up shortly. So let me just tell you what's going on. So yesterday, Air Force Two was fired up, ready to go. And J.D. Vance, Steve Witkoff, Jared Kushner were ready to go. And they were going to fly to Islamabad about 18 hours, huge commitment. And they were going to meet with the round two of these talks because the ceasefire was expanded to be extended depending on the progress of the talks. Finally, there was a go. And at the last minute, the Pakistanis called the president and said, look, the Iranians can't get their act together. The IRGC meeting with the foreign minister, we're not going to be empowered to do any type of deal or do the type of deal that they wanted to that wouldn't be successful. So they're not showing up. So the president's got a choice to make. And according to one report, his aides did not know what choice he was going to make. I mean, literally, he's a president that takes in advice, yes. But first and foremost, he goes with his decisions. And he didn't know if they were going to be knocking out power stations and bridges or if they were going to extend the ceasefire. And at the urging of the Pakistanis, the president said, let's just extend ceasefire. Because they're not saying they're not showing up because of something we did. They're not showing up because they can't get their act together. And that's the whole thing. So the president decides to take the 3 to 5 day ceasefire. Now, he could change his mind, especially if the rhetoric keeps coming out the way it's coming out. Now, they say they're in charge and they're going to open up. They're going to close down the strait. They've already taken two ships into custody. We've actually found one as far away off the coast of Sri Lanka that was heading to Iran. Nothing is getting in and out. They claim 26 ships got in and out. There might be one or two, but for the most part, we have a blockade that's been thoroughly effective. Now, they have the Strait of Hormuz, which has shut everything down, which has caused the Europeans to put together 30 different countries and find a way to open up the strait without us involved, by the way. Think about that for a second. So we got a Navy. They got basically a handful of ships. They're going to not consult with us, but figure out a way to open up the strait. What they might do, and I fear this, they actually might start paying ransom for it, extortion. And what a bad precedent that would be. We could take any body of international waters and say, okay, we declare that as ours. Pay money. Guess who's looking at that? China, to see if we would actually do that. So where do we go from here? Victor Davis Hanson, not only a historian, but a military historian. Cut six.
Well, I think he's going to go over there and tell China there's a lot of oil in the Persian Gulf. You've got all the Gulf sheikdoms are happy to sell you oil. And the new regime, if we can get a new regime, it's going to be an open market. You're welcome to come in. Just don't come in with this regime in power and don't buy oil from them and don't sell them weapons. It's very simple. And I think that'll give a lot of pressure from China on the regime.
How about buying from us? Let China buy from us. You know, yes, we have very good oil. We can get over there pretty fast.
I think we got a lot of people want to buy from us, though. I hope we have enough oil. Everybody wants to buy from us now.
I really think we got to go back in. I don't take that lightly. I don't think it's no big deal. I think it's a big deal. It's going to cost us a lot of money, but we got the firepower, and we got the experience, we got the plans. We also have been going to school on what Iran has been doing since the fighting stopped. We're watching with them with the tractors and the heavy machinery, trying to dig out their launchers, dig out their missile program. We're seeing what happens, what emerges. We're going to town, we're assessing the damage and what's not been damaged. And then we also probably went to school on how to better protect the Gulf states. The president says they're losing $500 million a day, and they have not even pushed back on that. They're facing severe financial collapse. Inflation's over 140%. Militarily, police evidently are not being paid, military not being paid, some of which are defecting, just not going to work. Iran urgently wants the strait to be reopened so they could get oil as well as sell oil, refine oil. They don't have much in terms of refinery. It's got to get out. They got to drill it. They got to get out. And then when they reach the storage capacity, they can't do that anymore. And if you don't keep these refineries going and you don't keep the drilling going, they're not sustaining itself. So in the big picture, there is a pause, but there is no resolution. The situation is fluid. It is no doubt volatile. If Iran submits a coherent proposal, they'll go back to talking. But the 10-point plan from 2 weeks ago is absolutely terrible. Remember I told you before about the shadow fleet? That's really how Iran has been financing itself, selling 80% of its oil to China. So yesterday, the U.S. captured a tanker named Tiffany in open waters between Sri Lanka and Indonesia. The Trump administration said in a directive, they'll interdict sanctioned vessels, not sanctioned as in allowed, but sanctioned as in you're not allowed, believed to be aiding Iran. One of the ships that we took, the only one we took when we blew up their engine room, had weaponry or stuff that could be used for weapons from China. I mean, if that doesn't poison relations, I don't know what is. Senator Rick Scott, we said we caught him red-handed, pun intended. Absolutely. So it's pretty amazing that the president's got to do something. It's going to be tough. He's doing it. He's got to make a huge decision on whether to fight again when the ceasefire is violated. He'll decide on that. But it's unbelievable to me how many people on the left, how about all of them not named John Fetterman, are just lining up against him. I mean, and some of the divisive comments are just out of line, cut nine. Minority Leader Jeffries.
First of all, we know Donald Trump is the dumbest president ever to sit at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and he's driving our country, our economy, into a ditch.
So, you don't like the president's decisions, okay? You don't like some of his aggressive tweets, okay? Dumbest president? So he fooled people in 2016, the biggest upset in history. In losing in 2020, he had more Republican votes than any in history. And in 2024, he won every battleground state in the popular vote. So if you're saying he's the dumbest president in history, you're saying the voters are the dumbest in history, too. And by the way, Jeffrey's just a clown. Is that the way, do you ever think Speaker Johnson would say that? He watched the decline of a president. We all did before our eyes. Not a Democrat spoke up about it. None. Including Jeffries, who met with him countless amount of times and still didn't up until the last day. And I don't think him since when he finally backed out and dropped out. And he's going to say dumbest president. People look at that. They think to themselves, man, I don't like this president. But America doesn't like him either. Like, they don't know that this guy is just trying to become a majority leader. They don't know that he's just trying to become the next speaker. Here's Brian Hook on where we're at right now. Who's Brian Hook? One of the most respected Iranian minds in the American fold. And they put a bounty on his life. Cut 19.
Anytime you have deep confusion inside of a dictatorship, you know that they're on the defensive. This isn't typically how dictatorships behave. You've got this quasi-civil war over who's in charge. And I think this shows that President Trump has put the Iranians on defense. And this is not a position the Iranians are used to being in.
So, and that's what it is. I mean, we have to make a habit of always looking at things good and bad from our perspective. But from their perspective, please tell me how they're better. They were bombed to oblivion in 2025. The nuclear program was brought to its knees and buried. As they started to dig out, it became obvious that they were going to reconstitute the nuclear program. So instead of just hitting it again and setting them back, they also managed to kill 40,000 people. So it prompted us to act. I do want to talk about things domestic before we get to Martha, and that's fine. And we'll talk more about that. Yesterday, by a point and a half, the yeses beat the noes. And it looks like Virginia is going to be radically redistricted. And it's going to be the detriment of the people of Virginia, who are basically a 51-49 state in favor of Democrats. It's a definition of purple. It was 6-5 in terms of congressional leaders. And now it's most likely going to be 10-1. They say it's in response to Texas. And they say it's going to be it's going to expire in 2030. I believe this. If Governor Spamberger wants to be governor and she's running for office and was going to do this, she had the obligation to tell the Virginia people what she's going to do. And says she does the complete opposite. Here's Lydia Moynihan of the New York Post. Cut 37.
Abigail Spanberger in Virginia pushed a referendum that was so dramatic, it basically gets rid of any Republican seats at all in Virginia. Even the Republicans are about 50% of the population there. And she, of course, had run on the fact that she wouldn't do that very thing. And yet when she got into power, she was very happy to try and change the rules to give Democrats an advantage. So in case you needed a more recent example of how Democrats don't play by the rules, I think we can just point to what happened earlier tonight in Virginia.
So the approximate gains is 2 to 4 seats. Republican advantages are elsewhere. In Missouri, they got one. In Florida, they're about to get it. North Carolina, they got a couple. In Texas, they got 5. So that'll go their direction. It seems to be roughly a wash, as they also delivered California. So California, they say, probably delivers 5 seats. Virginia probably delivers Democrats roughly between 6 probably 6 of the 11 seats. Now you get Texas with 5 seats, as I mentioned. Missouri will give 1 to the GOP. North Carolina will give 1 to the GOP. Ohio will give 2 to the GOP. Utah will give 1 to the Democrats, which I find astounding. And now we're going to see what Florida will do. Maryland failed to do anything. Court stopped it. Courts could still reverse what Virginia did. So the president did start this. It was a calculated risk. Right now, it seems to be a flat-footed tie, which means no one benefits. And it's this House, I believe, is going to be decided by 3 or 4 separate races. I think the race is yet to be won by issues that have yet to be defined, much of which is because we don't know how the Iran war is going to turn out, where if it's going to be a complete victory for the president, even though the war technically is unpopular, it'll gain momentum when people see the positive outcome. And Cuba, it lies in wait, and the next thing you're going to see is oil and gas drop precipitously. Martha McCallum in next. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Do you worry that states, districts all over the country now will just go tit for tat trying to do this, not every 10 years, but whenever they feel the need?
I certainly think that that is a fair concern, which is why absolutely when Democrats take a majority in the House of Representatives, my hope and expectation will be that there will be serious conversations about redistricting reforms and the process by which all 50 states will take on redistricting efforts. But I think essential to the conversation, as I mentioned, in Virginia was our commitment to our bipartisan commission. And so I think it's important that every step along the way, we weren't saying, okay, this is the new normal of this kind of tit for tat.
So that is the governor of Virginia talking about the win to redistrict severely Virginia. 51.5 yeses to 48.5 noes. With us right now is Martha McCallum. Martha, this is it. Now it looks like it could be 10-1 for Democrats over Republicans instead of 6-5 Democrats over Republicans.
Yeah, 89,000 votes separated yes and no. We've seen, you know, Governor Youngkin very outspoken on this issue, trying to get people to vote no on this. And I think there are some questions just from a political organization standpoint of whether or not the GOP should have been putting more money into this situation. There's one more round that goes through the Supreme Court. There's 3 different cases, and the lead case in the Supreme Court in Virginia is whether or not it was even constitutional in their state to, in the Commonwealth, to have this ballot as a referendum at all. That this is not the way that they change districts.
They already had
districts.
An independent commission.
Exactly. So I think that the story's not completely told on this. However, I think that it's something that everyone in rural America across the country needs to stand up and pay attention to. Because if you're a farmer or a rural voter in Virginia, right, in Western Virginia, near West Virginia, you are potentially, your representative is a lobbyist from Arlington. He doesn't understand, or she doesn't understand. Yeah. How you feel. Representative government is the beauty of America. And if those rural districts don't have a representative in Congress who understands their world, then that is not a representative government.
Yeah, that is a great point. Ari Fleischer was one of the many people who came out and said, look, the money was, you know, the Republicans were viciously outspent, and everybody was late to the party here. It's like they didn't realize the ramifications or didn't think they had a shot to win. But obviously, when you get this close, they had a shot to win because they seem to be losing just about everything since the 2024 election. But if you look at it, it basically is 50-50. I was just going over it with the audience. In California, they picked up 5 for the Democrats. They just got the seats in Virginia, as I mentioned. Texas, they picked up 5 in theory, picked up 1 in Missouri, picked up 1 in North Carolina, picked up 2 in Ohio. Utah, Democrats now have a shot at getting 1 seat. Maryland, it failed the referendum. And then Florida is being queued up to redistrict there.
Right. So now there's pressure on Governor DeSantis to try to balance this number out. And I think based off the numbers that you just read, I heard an assessment this morning that it all shakes out to plus one Democrat. After all that, we think about the millions and millions of dollars that are spent in these redistricting fights all across the country by both parties, right? Yeah. And I actually agree with one thing that Governor Spanberger said there. There needs to be a sort of codified method for this districting, and it cannot be a partisan effort. It has to be based on population. Movement of population can certainly change a district in terms of the size of it, but these kinds of, you know, really calculated gerrymandering, and both sides have been guilty of it over the years. Right. Absolutely. It's not representative.
I want you to hear what James Carville said. I think it's worthy for people to understand what's going to happen if the Senate and the House flip, and if for some reason the President of the United States ends up being Democrat.
If the Democrats win the presidency in both houses of Congress, I think on day one, they should make Puerto Rico, D.C. a state, and they should expand the Supreme Court to 13. Eat our dust. The only way to fight this is don't run on it. Don't talk about it. Just do it. She said, okay, we got 54 senators and we got 13 court members. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you.
You're not going to get a fair shake any kind of way in this system. 18% of the United States elects 52 senators. Well, you're not going to make it equitable, but you'll make it better by adding Puerto Rico and D.C.
So he is talking about it. And if I'm a Republican, I'm running that in my
district. Just going to say thank you, James Carville, for just creating commercials for Republicans all across the country, because that is exactly the kind of, you know, fear that a lot of people on the conservative side will be motivated by. There's no doubt about it.
Another thing would be, I'm going to impeach Trump if I win. Okay, good luck with that. The American people are not on board with that. They know the whole country stops, and then you see the partisan play. But I think, you know, for the Republicans to figure out what they're doing, I think the war's got to come to an end. And how it ends has everything to do with what you can run on in the fall.
I agree. I think that, you know, the point needs to be continually made that this is a fight that the United States has been in for 47 years. Okay. No president has, and I know President Trump says this a lot, but I think this is a fact. No president has had the guts to try to take on this regime. And that's what we're going through now. And I think that the real legacy fact, Jack, do you want your kids to live under this threat of terrorism and their kids or not?
Yeah, we're going to talk about that when we get back. Martha McCallum, show at 3 o'clock. Don't move.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, we are back. Martha McCallum is here, and Martha's show is at 3 o'clock today. And before we start talking about Iran and the absolute latest, because literally, you know, since do you get all your papers online now?
Yeah.
So I'm going in. So now you don't even read like the story. All you do is go to the TikTok. 22 minutes ago, they said this. 11
exactly.
minutes ago, they said that. Because what you say suddenly sounds out of step if you take your eyes off it for a minute.
I know. I said, you know, for like all of the different posts, including, of course, the president's posts on Truth Social, you have to not only have the hour, but you have to have the minutes and sometimes the seconds for which post came out when, so that you know whether or not it's a response to something that was said on the other side. So it's bouncing ball.
All right. So who's going to be on your show?
Well, we have Caroline Leavitt at 3 o'clock this afternoon. So it'll be interesting to hear from her about what went on yesterday, why the decision was made to delay. Obviously, there's a new window now during which there will be a continued blockade, but the potential for more talks. So, and then you've got Iran seizing ships. So there's a lot to talk to Caroline about. Also, these efforts this week to turn the page 6 months from the midterms and have this, they had a big meeting with Republican consultants about how to approach the midterms 6 months away.
Interesting. Iran and forces have claimed to have seized two ships and are holding on to those ships. One's Panamanian or Panamanian flagged,
right,
and one is UK.
Right. So it's so tricky. One of the things that really baffles my mind about this story is that there's no video. Like, everything that happens in the world, we get all of this iPhone video that's shot there, right? In no instance have I seen, you know, a video from one ship of another ship being seized, or look, this is the reality in the middle of the Strait of Hormuz. There's actually only two ships that got through today. It's all being done by satellite, and all of these companies are so difficult to pin down. Because I was saying to Lauren Simonetti, who's following this very closely, so the ships that Iran seized, obviously they weren't theirs. Obviously they're someone else's. You said Panamanian. I think there was a Liberian flag on the other one. Whose stuff are they carrying? What's on the ship? Why did they seize that ship? And where is the ship now? The black hole of information on exactly what's going on in that strait, I find very interesting in the world that we live in.
Yeah. So they say, the IRGC seized two ships, container ships. The other one is Panamanian. The other is the UK Maritime Trade Operations, a shipping monitor run by the British Navy, reported that two ships have been attacked near the strait, one by gunboat belonging to the guard. Iranian news media reports that the guards have been targeting two cargo vessels. So they're looking to stop all traffic that goes through there. Mm-hmm. Now, Admiral McCraven brought up in a previous hour today, he said, I would release the blockade and make them open up the strait and then do talks. And if the talks fall apart, it's very easy. As a Navy guy, I trust his knowledge, to put that blockade back on. Mm-hmm. But you're reluctant because you say, why are we letting them refill or sell their oil?
Well, this is obviously one of the big things that President Trump has to decide, because a lot of people who watch the oil rig production facility part of this closely say that if you keep that blockade in for another few weeks, and 2 to 3 weeks, they are going to be in a very difficult situation because they have nowhere to offload the oil. That means that they can't continue to produce oil. And once you stop producing oil, those rigs atrophy very quickly, and it will dry up a huge part of their economy and their ability to make money. Now, are they able to, you know, offload it somewhere else? You know, clearly they have routes to get things through and to make some money on this, but it would make a significant dent in their what's left of their economy, which is in tatters.
And I want to bring you to this. There's about 10 women who were caught up in the protests and jailed, and they're about to be executed, hanged, we believe. And the president's saying, as a gesture, don't hang him. Let him live. So Karine Hajjar on Fox News at Night said this about the president's move on trying to get their execution canceled. Cut 16.
This is certainly a message, and we have to remember that at the beginning of the year, the president really stood up for protesters and dissenting voices in Iran. Now, I think this is both an opportunity for the Iranians to prove that they're going to come to the table, but this is also a test for the president. Remember, he said that he was going to be there for the protesters, and of course, what followed was a brutal crackdown from the regime. And so I really hope that the regime obviously does the right thing, but never underestimate the mullah's capability for great evil.
So what do you think?
So I also thought it was very interesting because we remember the president saying help is on the way and clearly signaling to the Iranian people that the goal was to overthrow this regime and to bring in a much more a country that countries around it can feel safe around and deal with and do commerce with and all of that. And then in the last few weeks, there's been very little discussion of the humanitarian side of this. And also, you know, it's our understanding that people were told, look, stay in your houses, do not come out and protest right now while we get through this stage of all of this. So I thought it was interesting. And I know there's been people who've been trying to communicate to the president, please put these people on your list. Please make this a point in the negotiation process. So that message got through clearly to the president. And now he is talking about these 8 to 10 women who are scheduled to hang. Two of them are 16 years old.
Yeah. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to intimidate people not to go protest. That's why they've gone over their 1989 ceiling on protests, deaths, or executions and hanged. There are over 1,500 now. Mm-hmm. People have just been hanged. So I just thought the Pope had plenty of time to weigh in on things like this. Mm-hmm. So that was the one thing that I don't understand, where you have clergy getting involved, but they're not pointing this out. Did you see the story about how China has an underground Catholic community and that the government is trying to weed them out and make them go to whatever the Chinese religion is? I would love for the Pope to speak out about things like that. I mean, but it's easy to beat up on the U.S., but it's not easy to say, Vladimir Putin, you're literally stealing children.
Well, the Pope did actually speak out about what happened in the streets of Iran. But I agree with you. I think that if, I mean, clearly, you know, the Pope is about wanting peace and wanting justice in the world. And all of these things merit his attention. I completely agree with you. Certainly what has happened in Iran and certainly what's happened in China. You know, in China, I believe it was Pope John Paul II made underground Catholics in China bishops, and I believe a couple of cardinals as well, underground Chinese Catholics. And we see what's happening in Africa with the killing of Christians in Nigeria and other places in Africa. This is a huge issue that, you know, the Holy Father is obviously disturbed about and can be such a huge voice for in the world. And I think there's reason to be hopeful that he will be.
Right. Yeah, let's hope. Let's see what goes on. Now, China is obviously affected by this when they buy 90% of the Iranian oil. Mm-hmm. Here's what their foreign minister said. Cut 25.
The situation in the Strait of Hormuz is sensitive and complex. China expresses concern over the United States' forced interception of relevant vessels and hopes that the parties concerned will act in a responsible manner, honor the ceasefire agreement, avoid aggravating confrontation and escalating tensions.
Well, the tensions are escalating. It wasn't avoided, but I find it interesting that they told Saudi Arabia to open up the strait. Do they not know how this works? If I was Saudi Arabia or if I'm the president, I pick up the phone and say, listen, Gulf states, when China comes to talk to you or do deals with you, make them make a choice. You want the terror regime that's been rocketing us and killing innocent people, or you want us? You can't have both.
Well, China can't have both either. You know,
that's what I mean. China can't have both.
They can't be on both sides of this equation. They clearly have given target information by selling satellite info to Iran. So they have put themselves on that side of the equation. And the Gulf states and the United States and Israel have forged a very interesting bond that is a sea change in the Middle East. So I think you're absolutely right. The other thing I think is really interesting, just as a side note, I was watching on Jesse's show last night, the Pentagon releasing images of these brand new landing craft boats that we have in our military that are incredible. They're like, you know, you picture the old LTVs from World War II mm-hmm. that can get right onto a beach and unload troops. These things are unbelievable. And all I could think watching it was, I wonder what China thinks about Taiwan when they see these landing boats and landing crafts mm-hmm. That are now being released, the pictures of them, what they can do by the Pentagon. I think that's a pretty clear message too for adversaries in China.
How long, Martha, do you think the president gives the ceasefire without any pledge on Iran's side to talk?
Here's the problem. You know, before all this started, I went to a lecture from a guy who had been, you know, studying Iran. He's a scholar of Iran for like 40 years. He said, this is the most complex leadership structure in the entire world. There's like 14 different groups that run things in Iran, all under, at that time, the Ayatollah Khamenei. Now, he was in charge for 37 years, and only that one guy was able to keep these 14 groups in line. But intermittently, some of those 14 groups got sent off to Evin prison. Right. Because they might have been stepping out of line. Somebody didn't like them. So they were all always afraid that they were about to be sent to prison if they made it look like they wanted to overthrow or overshadow the Ayatollah or the leadership. So now you cut the head of the snake off and you've got this guy who replaced him that nobody ever hears from. So all you've got are these kind of wild different 14 factions. So I honestly don't know if we're ever going to get to a point where there's like a coherent leadership that can actually make some sort of deal.
Well, so if that doesn't happen, do we go back to bombing?
Well, I think that the blockade is a very powerful tool mm-hmm. and gives us a lot of control. You don't need Karg Island if you have, you know, real control over what can get in and what can get out. And eventually, Iran's economy is going to be choked off if they can't get anything through that strait.
Right. Do you think that other Gulf states should contribute militarily?
Definitely. And I think we've already seen they were attacked. Right. Yeah. Remember the early stages of this? Everyone said, wow, I can't believe Iran is attacking the Gulf states. That's stupid. You know, now they're just going to rile them up and they'll never be on their side again. Well, that's exactly what has happened. We've also seen that, you know, thanks to a lot of American equipment that they bought, these Gulf states were able to defend themselves fairly right. well and do things that they had never done before in combat. So, yeah, I think that the prominence of the Gulf state picture, they want this over. They want Iran. Mm-hmm. I mean, ideally, like they want this regime gone.
I think everybody does.
Everybody does.
Except Hezbollah and Hamas. Yeah,
I guess, you know, I mean, I don't even know who's running those organizations anymore. I guess it's this guy who's the head of the IRGC. But yeah, the dynamic is changing. And I think, you know, I keep thinking about Braveheart when he goes up and down the line and he's telling the guys, they're all like ready to fight. Hold, hold, hold. Mm-hmm. Right. And I feel like that's where we are right now with this suspension of this meeting. Hold, mm-hmm. just hold.
And I think we've been very busy bulking up and analyzing the damage we did and didn't do. And see what Iran's trying to do. What are they digging out? We're watching everything. I wish we could find one way to get the internet back on to empower the people to communicate. It'd be great to see an uprising inside Iran. Go ahead.
I just want to know why the British didn't shoot back at the little boat that took over their tanker.
Is that what it seems?
I'm just curious. Like, you know,
are tankers armed?
Well, that's a good question. But you said it was a British military vessel. Is that right? I mean, I thought they were both cargo ships and maybe had some sort of British flag involvement, but that would be a question I'd want answered.
The UK Maritime Trade Operations.
Oh, okay.
A shipping monitor run by the British Navy.
So, okay.
Okay.
So I have more questions.
Reported that two ships had been attacked near the strait.
Mm-hmm. There's more to that story.
One by the gunboat belonging to the Revolutionary Guard. Iranian's news media reported that the guards had targeted two cargo vessels, the MSC Francesca and the something unpronounceable, and the forces Navy later claimed to have seized the ships after they attempted to navigate without the necessary permits. So this is a little
interesting strange. To see if the UK is confirming that side of the story.
Yeah, and so far I do not see them speaking out and demanding the release.
We know how reluctant they were to be involved, so maybe the Iranians targeted that ship because they want to scare them off.
Do you know they're meeting right now? Led by Britain, without us.
Yeah.
Back in a moment.
Bye.
Real talk, real guests, real insight. Where curiosity meets conversation. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
What we allege in the indictment and what the grand jury found is that one of the individuals that they paid was one of the folks who helped organize that terrible event. And so imagine what we're talking about, Laura. We're talking about an organization that actively came out and just screamed it from the top of their lungs.
And what they're talking about, the Southern Poverty Law Center that is out there to battle the forces of evil, but yet they're financing the forces of evil. It looks like, and that was Todd Blanche you just heard from, who was kind enough to be a guest on our show last week, that there's accusations that there have been six charges of wire fraud, four charges of bank fraud, and one charge of money laundering conspiracy. Martha McCallum, as you get ready for your 3 o'clock show, I would not be surprised if this made the cut, because it looks like the DOJ says that they put $3 million funneling to extremist-linked individuals. $1 million for the National Alliance affiliate, which is a white supremacist organization. $300,000 for the Aryan Nations. $270,000 for, get this, Charlottesville Unite the Right linked organization. They were all over that. And $73,000 for the former former KKK member. I mean, what are they doing?
This story is incredible. So this organization, which at one point was very highly respected as an organization that would help to defend people against racism and Jim Crow laws and all of that, I think it started in 1970, so after the Civil Rights Act, but, you know, really to be on the cutting edge of helping people who needed representation and couldn't afford it. So now they're giving millions of dollars to put, they're putting undercover people into these volatile situations where in many cases you have these right-wing groups who are, you know, sort of ready to kind of ignite with the slightest match. So they put someone, according to this indictment, they put someone right into the middle of, and who knows what their role was. I hope this investigation finds out, the Charlottesville event, the Charlottesville torch marchers that ended up in the death of a woman. Like, what? This is not a law enforcement agency.
That President Trump famously said there were good people on both sides. Mm-hmm. That prompted President Biden to get into the race. Said, when I saw President Trump say,
By the way, that was about the statue.
Yes.
That was not about the marchers with the torches. The
same incident.
Yes, but very important distinction.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can you imagine this? It's like, for example, let's say I work security at Fox and they did an analysis and they go, we don't need security at Fox. Imagine if I staged a bombing in order for people to say, I need security at Fox. So they're saying, we got to make sure we have, that there's a place for us in the world of fighting against the world of extremists. So they're financing the world of extremists.
Yes. Exactly. And they're saying that I believe that, you know, their argument will be, and I know Hakeem Jeffries is coming out in support of them, that they were merely doing sort of like their own investigations into these groups.
Oh, really?
And they had to infiltrate them by becoming one of them. But that's like, you know, that's an intelligence operation. That is not an operation that is supposed to be done by a legal organization that's designed to support people who don't have money to defend themselves.
I know. Listen, I 100%.
This is a shocking story. I mean, I think, and the other thing is, the investigation was started in the Biden administration, and then they dropped it.
Yes.
So why
would that be?
Why did they drop it?
Because they realized that Joe Biden ran for president for no reason then. Lastly, and the most controversial, and I'm going to demand you take a stand, do you believe that the Mets have lost 11 in a row because the mayor, Mamdani, hugged Mr. and Mrs. Met?
I mean, it certainly looks that way.
We have nothing else to conclude.
It certainly looks that way. I mean, how much money have the Mets spent?
$345 million on a payroll.
No, that's so sad. My husband is very, very depressed about it.
I'm still going to the game on Sunday. Martha, I can't wait for your show at 3 o'clock
today.
You'll
win when you show up.